On this episode of the podcast, I have Spencer Holt, PhD. Now, Spencer is the head of Commercial Learning Innovation Center at AstraZeneca. So he has a role that is pretty knee-deep in learning and development. And in particular, our conversation is going to be around leadership. Spencer also has his own podcast, Small Things Make a Big Difference, which is definitely worth checking out. Had a great time with Spencer. It was one of those conversations that the moment I got into it with him, I realized I was absolutely with a kindred spirit in the sense of the way he has really clearly thought through his thinking. And it just led to a set of conversations that were very easy, very natural. And for me as well, it helped me verbalize some of my ideas. And it was fantastic to hear Spencer talk about his perspective. So enjoy the podcast. Welcome to Leadership Bites with myself, your host, Guy Bloom. This is a leadership podcast where I have conversations with colleagues, I chat with guests, and sometimes they'll be just me talking. You can connect with me at livingbrave.com, and when you enjoy the episode, subscribe and please tell everyone. So, Spencer, great to have you on this episode of Leadership Bites.
Super excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, an absolute pleasure. I came across you on LinkedIn, which seems to be my entire focus for making contact with the world at the moment. And I saw a video of you with your daughter, and it just engaged me so much that you already know, but I reached out and said hi to you, and here we are today.
It's so funny. My daughter is my chief operating officer of my podcast, Small Things Make a Big Difference. And we did this kind of fun little video. And you know, to your point, it's funny how things attracts people's attentions, right? It's like today, anything that's authentic and is a little bit different, that is more humanizing, people are like, oh my gosh, I'll watch that one. And I've just been amazed at how many people have watched it, but also the connections we've made from it. So I'm super excited we've made this connection, however it came about.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, again, just you saying that about something very real. I think that's the nature that we're getting into now, which is why anybody that's listening to a podcast must know who Joe Rogan is, right? And,
yeah.
You know, the whole nature of his $1 billion sale to Spotify, which basically signifies that Joe Rogan's won the internet, is that it's all just done through that kind of element of just trusting conversations and talking to people that you like, which is the essence of what this is about. So...
Yeah, may your podcast turn into the Joe Rogan, okay? Like, can we go for that guy? Would that be amazing?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that it's the old story. Everybody says it, don't they? You know, a famous person can probably set out to do something that will be a success. I'm already famous, so the chances are, you know, if I've written a bestseller, the chances are I could do the next one that's a bestseller. But when you write Harry Potter, or you start that first podcast before the internet even knows what podcasting is, like Rogan did, you don't know, do you? You're sat at home thinking, I bet no bugger reads this or even listens to it. And, you know, a decade later, wallop, you're one of the most known people in the universe.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I think it's a great example of almost like passion and purpose, right? Like where... You know, it's something where you know, like for him, you stick with it because it's a passion and it aligns with kind of his ethos. And and it might not pay off at the beginning, but my goodness, you know, long term, I always say, I think passion, purpose, and expertise, the marketplace rewards eventually. And you know, may we all kind of find out what our own rhythm is in that sense.
I think passion, purpose, and expertise must be a T-shirt.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, it's a bloody great title for a book. If it isn't one already, I'll
see if I can beat you to copy.
My next book, Passion, Purpose, and Expertise. Hashtag sense. Thank you, Spencer. You know, from my point of view, I know who you are because I've said hello to you and I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile. But it would be great just to do a little introduction. That if the question is, who the heck is Spencer Holt? Who are you, and what do you do?
Perfect. Yeah, I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. I'm, you know, first of all, I'm a husband. I'm a father of four kids, and you know that really drives everything that I do. And I'm incredibly grateful for my family. I grew up in Alberta, Canada, and have had the privilege of living in Canada. I've lived in the United States, in Las Vegas, Nevada, California. I now live in Pennsylvania. I've lived in England for 5 years, and have had this incredible career journey that has you know, I first started off as a commercial banker. And, you know, I think anytime if you're a little bit entrepreneurial and you're a banker, you're going to find somebody or some clients that are like, hey, we've got money and a good idea. And so from that, from the banking, I went to this small oil and gas startup, which was amazing and fun. And that was my first real dip into leadership at 27 years old, asked to run a really small company of only about 5 or 6 people. But it was the moment I realized I didn't know enough about leadership. Like at 28, you think you can, you know, do anything. And so I was like, sure, I'll go and do this, and realized I don't know enough. I need to learn more. And so from the oil and gas, I went, did my master's in adult education, and really with the purpose of trying to understand why do people learn the way that they learn, and how do we influence behavior? And I was set at that point, how do I become a better leader? And you know, so I did my master's and I was about to start my PhD, and we just was having our second child. And my wife was like, you should probably go back to work because education doesn't pay that much. So I started then at AstraZeneca as a pharmaceutical sales representative, but continued on with my education. And so I've been did sales reps for a couple years and became a sales leader, left AstraZeneca, opened up some restaurants back to Canada, and we opened up Five Guys Burgers and Fries, for those that know the franchise.
Yeah, of course.
Incredible experience of running a small business. And, you know, when you're in that area, you do a little bit of everything from you flip the burgers, you find the locations, you hire the people. And we did that for a year and had a great lesson in venture capitalists.
And you justify a $10 shake.
Yeah, exactly. So we did that. And then I came back to AstraZeneca, where I currently am now, and I've done some really fun roles, but today I'm the head of Commercial Learning Innovation Center, where I get to help the commercial organization in our, you know, in everything that we do from a learning perspective, from sales and coaching, et cetera. So, and I really love what I get to do right now.
So there's a little part of me that wants to talk about burgers right now, but I'm going to fight that because the first time I saw a Five Guys burger in the UK, and I sat down and went, well, how good can it be? 2 minutes later, you go, oh God, this is really good. You know, it's like when you don't know wine, and then somebody gives you a good bottle, you go, oh, damn it.
Yeah.
Right? This is now my standard and my benchmark. So
they've got a great business model. They do an incredible product, and it was a really fun experience. Absolutely.
And it's amazing what you do learn. I used to work, but when I first started after school, you'll know it as Radio Shack in the US, but see, it was Tandy in the UK, and running a retail shop. And as you say, you do a little bit of everything, right? You stock take, you do the P&L, you're selling, you're hiring. So in this microcosm, I think retail is one of the greatest groundings of actually understanding the end-to-end process of something.
Absolutely. And it lets you kind of realize what parts you like and what parts you don't. And so to your point, I'm like, may everybody have a little, you know, dip your toe in that for sure.
You can definitely tell the difference between somebody that's been in a very linear role progression. And it doesn't mean they're not an expert, and it doesn't mean they're not incredibly capable, but very often their frame of reference or their benchmark for what actually reality might look like can sometimes be a little bit tighter than most if they've had that foray into something else. So I really recognize that.
It's so true. In fact, you know, lots of people, you know, I do lots of kind of coaching and one-on-one, you know, development. And one of the things I'm not even sure it matters around age, but it's that diversity of experience that is so important, because to your point, I think it does two things. One, it increases your context of how you view the world, but it also, I think, increases your empathy of how you lead others because of the context that you have versus sometimes that linear, I've been in one industry the whole time, or I've done this kind of one sleeve. I think it, you know, at times, limits our ability if we're not intentional in how we view the world.
Yeah, I totally buy into that. And I have noticed just in the way that certain things are happening, especially in the world right now with education, there's a kind of a sense of a shift to do we necessarily look for people with a first kind of Ivy League education? Or actually, can't we just put out, I think, is it Google that are just putting some courses online and just saying basically do those and then apply? Because we're not really, but if you've passed the courses online, that's what we want you to do. Now come and then come and we'll find out if we actually want to employ you, you know.
It's so true. You know, today it's because the internet and technology has made knowledge available to everybody. And, you know, look, I think, you know, the Harvards, the MITs, the Cambridge and Oxfords of the world, you know, there's something amazing about the way that they help people learn. However, it's not the only place to learn now. And I think what organizations are realizing is it's not just education, it's education plus experience and context that people can bring that really actually is what makes a great, great leader and employee that can, I think, do the things that organizations need today, right? It's innovate and think differently and not try to solve problems the way that they solved them, you know, 5 or 10 years ago.
I totally buy into that. And I think what the internet has done, it's a leveler for people that don't have access to the best. And if you've got that access, because hey, maybe just educationally you're of that level or you've got that background or whatever it is, but you know, Susan and Fred in the middle of nowhere can get online and have access to the thinking of the greatest in their field, direct into their home, potentially even better learning and education than if they went to a local education establishment.
Yeah, absolutely. I've once heard it coined the democratization of learning, right? Where it's no longer an elitist or we make it available to everybody. And I think what is so great about that is, you know, I think we have a long ways to go to ensuring that everyone has access to it. But I think it also helps us recognize and find individuals that you traditionally wouldn't have. And you start to find talent in places that you wouldn't have traditionally searched for. And I love this spirit of learning for all, and let's break down the hierarchy that traditionally existed around access to, you know, education and information.
Yeah, I think, and there's something else, isn't there, that says, if you didn't have the steady line of sight on your education, it was obvious you were going to go to this space and then to that place, etc. But you, through your sheer thirst or love of it or personal will, have sought it out and learned. That says something about the kind of human being I want in this business.
Absolutely. And, you know, you think about, I think societally, my personal opinion is I think we're doing a good job. I think we need to do a better job of helping individuals that maybe don't see that path, right? To your point, there will be some people that just out of sheer will find a way to have access. But I think today, because of technology, we need to continue to say, let's ensure that every part of the population not only have access, but sees examples that they can do it. Because, you know, for many people, if they don't actually see a path or see examples that they can relate to, it still becomes a real hindrance to them being able to jump over the many obstacles that could happen. And so that's something I'm, you know, really passionate about, is saying, how do we continue that democratization, but also giving people examples of here's people in, you know, that look like you, that are around you, that have broken through the ceiling because of the access to learning today.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I notice after your name, you have those immortal three letters, P, H, and D, which always indicate that you've done something above the ordinary. So what was the focus of that?
You know, so what's funny is I remember when I decided to go get my PhD, it was in the middle of my master's program. I had a professor, his name was Dr. Ackerman, and he was a great example of someone that understood theory, but also understood practical application to theory, because he had worked in not just academia. And I remember sitting there one day thinking, I want to be a professor one day and be able to inspire, not just through the knowledge piece, but through the practical application. And so I remember, you know, going home to my wife and I was like, I'm gonna get my PhD. And my wife's amazing. She was like, great. She's a nurse and, you know, loves education as well. And it took us, you know, so we had our second child, And I started my PhD as with a full-time job. It took me 7 years. It took us because you, if you're married and we had two more kids while I was doing my PhD and working full-time, it was at times a real grind, but I loved it because the focus was all around leadership development. And my dissertation was, how do you build effective leadership development programs? And so, you know, when you pursue a passion, it oftentimes doesn't feel like work. And so thankfully, there were times where I loved what I was doing, where you could balance and spend the extra nights or early mornings that you needed to do in order to either write that essay or finish the dissertation and to balance everything that life was putting at us at that time.
So how do you build effective leadership programs? I mean, that's your key to the door right there, really, or the how do you nail jelly to a wall kind of question. Is that accessible for people to read, or is that it's in my drawer, and if somebody asks for it, I might let them read it.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, you can look at it up online. I mean, it's a dissertation, so I would not say it's the most exciting piece of work, right? Because it's in that big dissertation form. But however, you know, right now I'm doing my podcast and similar to you, my podcast is called Small Things Make a Big Difference. And I interview leaders all over the world, and it's a collection of insights. And it's been really interesting to go through and hear individuals share what small thing they do as a leader that makes a big impact in the lives of the people they interact with. And so eventually that will become my book, right? Like I'm comparing that to my dissertation, but also, you know, I did my dissertation years ago, and you start to see the evolution. I think what the world needs, I think the world needs a different type of leader. You know, as an example, the world, and I think leadership used to be about having answers and being able to, you know, plan and predict. Well, the world today, at the speed and the rate of information and technology, has changed that to now leaders need to sense and respond, and we don't have the answers. What we need to be able to do is ask the right questions and to, you know, to surround ourselves with people that are super smart, and not to be intimidated by that, but to bring out the very best in them and to help guide and say, let's together explore what the future should look like. And so I think we're seeing a change in what leadership looks like, which is incredibly exciting.
I spoke to Dave Ulrich on the podcast, and he said a couple of things that resonate with me to what you just said, which is, you know, I don't really want to be known for something that was an idea 25 years ago, which may have changed and evolved. And there's something about that, you know, the thing that you wrote, you know, by definition, you know, your perception has shifted or the environment has shifted. So it may have been amazingly valid at the time, but it should have grown over that sort of period of time. But I also, he hadn't come across the thinking of it. It's this idea of tame and wicked problems. I don't know if you've ever come across that.
Mm-mm, no.
Yeah, it's Rittle and Weber, and it's one of those few things that I can sort of quote off the top of my head to sound like I actually know my topic. It's this idea that certain issues are tame because you've dealt with them before, or the some parts of your reporting sort of, or your peer group between you all, you can figure it out because, you know, Fred's got half the answer, Susan's got half the answer, so between us we'll figure it out. And then we've got those wicked problems, which are, does anybody know anything about this? Has anybody dealt with this context before? No. Right then. Mm-hmm. So actually now we're in this wicked space where the some part of our knowledge doesn't actually enable us to make or define the answer. And that's quite an interesting set of, if you don't have the culture that can sit with an idea that might sound random, or the idea that may only be the kernel of an idea, but you don't even know where it's going to go, i.e. we don't speak unless you've got the answer kind of back in the day, then that doesn't serve you anymore.
Could not agree more with that. And I've been fascinated with this concept, and it's been around for a little bit, but it's similar to what you've just described, the tame and the wicked. It's, you know, this concept of ambidextrous leadership, and it's, you know, it's this, you know, the balance of, you know, I'm holding up two hands, my left hand and right hand. And, you know, the theory of, you know, your left hand is all about exploiting current business. So, you know, the things that you know, and you do, and you execute on a daily basis, because that's what drives performance. And then on the right hand, or the, you know, the other side of the equation is this, you know, what are you exploring, to your point, like the wicked problems of today? And how do we make sure that we're always doing both? Because you can't live in either camp. Today's leaders have to be able to balance both tame and wicked, or explore and exploit. But then, to your point, create a culture of it so that you, it's not just you doing it, but it's your teams, and you create an organization that understands the appropriate balance for their role, and how we start to explore and be innovative for the future, and how those lessons that we're learning and things that we're experimenting with eventually turns into the exploit, so that we eventually, you know, so that we're evolving, so that we're not continually to do the same things over and over again, expecting different results. And so I couldn't agree more with you that we need more of that. And it's so much easier said than done, because it is a culture. It, as much as it is a skill issue of being able to balance, and, you know, I love Clayton Christensen's works around innovators' DNA, like how do you build skill for exploration or innovation? But there is also this cultural phenomenon of, if you don't have the right culture that rewards that and makes it psychologically safe for people to try things and make mistakes, you'll always come up short in that area.
Yeah, there's something here that really resonates with me, which is this idea of what are the permissions, and what permission do I have to not do the thing that is actually going to be, in the immediate sense, judged and rewarded or punished.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I get rewarded or punished for not having got 9 nails into a piece of wood by the end of the week, dependent on my kind of permission to self, or the permission that I feel I've got, my focus will be exactly on where I think I'm going to get the reward or the punishment.
Totally. And I think this is still where both organizations and leaders struggle with, because, you know, whenever we reward performance, or even if we reward like breakthrough innovations, we always love to tell the story of heroics, like where, you know, we did this, but I seldom see where we talk about or share the narrative of the mistakes, or the moments of doubt where I wasn't sure. And I think when we skip that, we actually short arm everybody in the organization to say, I could never do that. Holy cow, that's amazing. When the reality is, it could have been a year long, like super hard progress experiment that, you know, had multiple mistakes. But if we don't get good at telling the story of how we get there, I think we're always going to struggle with psychological safety.
And I like that a lot. I think there's that instinct to reward the big step, as opposed to the incremental and the mundane.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, there are things that are, well, if changing that process was incremental and mundane, but it just made everybody go, thank heavens for that. And we do a lot of those this year, per se, we'll have done a lot of innovation, or we'll have done a lot of growth.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
But it might not be, we may not have invented the next big thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I always, you know, I always say, well, I love the example of like the iPhone, right? It's an example of this combinatorial innovation. It wasn't anything brand new. It was like, you took the iPhone, you took the iPod, and you took then you took the internet and you combined it into one. And it's sometimes just getting individuals to think at things differently and try and combine, versus, to your point, like it seldom is the big idea that hits the home run the very first time. And I think we need to help people understand these stories, and I always call it the grind, right? Like, there's a grind to every big experiment, or a grind to every big innovation. We just need to share it more.
What's your line of sight on how you bring that idea of learning to not be a task, but actually to be something that people see as something that is in the essence of what they're about, if they're in a leadership space? I don't know if that's just because, well, we hire right guy, but how do you make that real?
Yeah, so it's a great question. This is, you start to hit one of the like passion areas for me is, you know, how, you know, one of the things that we try to do within my function and how we operate inside the broader organization is, how do we help make learning a strategic driver to performance. So where individuals realize learning is not a task or a check mark, but learning becomes, if I'm trying to hit certain targets or I'm trying to do certain things, how do I use learning as one of the main strategic drivers to say, this is what's going to get me to do that? And so one of the things that we've really focused on within our own team is ensuring that learning is not seen as a moment in time or a task, but that we, and Josh Burson talks about this, it's learning in the flow of work so that we can see the moments of evolution in the way that we operate, that as we grab bite-sized bits of knowledge and information, we can apply it in the moment and recognize that my behavior change was because I sought out new perspectives, new information, and I'm now doing something different and it's actually helping me excel. And so we really follow that principle of learn in the flow of work, see learning as a strategic driver. And then also then how do we ensure that we provide, and I was, you know, today content is everywhere, but I believe the learner experience is now king, right? Because if you don't love, you know, if we put something out that's not great, they're going to go find it somewhere else. And so I think there's something about ensuring that the science of how adults learn today, that we embrace that for every learning experience. So when someone sits down and does it or grabs it on the go, they're like, this was awesome. And it was exactly what I needed. But I didn't, you know, and it wasn't anything more and it wasn't anything less. And, you know, we're still trying to find that, but that's kind of been our journey.
And in large organizations, there is the, you know, that balance between the mandatory, it doesn't matter if you want to do it, you've got to, you know, all the way through to, you know, people's development. And I think I'm kind of interested in certain things, having come into contact with some emergency services and the military, when they come to learning and their willingness to learn, particularly the emergency services, in the moment and to review in the moment and even change direction in the moment. And there's something there about the fact that because what they're doing is so relevant to maybe somebody's life or whatever it might be, in that second, this concept of, and I love that learning in the flow of work, is that the, you know, the hot debriefs, the willingness to review and to not see feedback as being, inverted commas, performance managed, but actually my growth in performance and my contribution to yours, which kind of leads me to this idea of what I seem to see in organizations, especially the larger ones, is if you can create an environment of, it's not just that I'm learning in isolation, am I willing to contribute to the learning of others? By giving them feedback, offering my counsel, being present in the contribution to your learning, etc. And that seems to be, if I see others around me doing it, then I'm more likely to feel that that's something that we do around here.
And it's such a hard, and I think this goes back a little bit around psychological safety to your point, because it's so hard, I think, to change the narrative around what you've just described. I learn because it actually is seen vital to my job and what I do, but also I'm okay if somebody, whether it's a peer or a leader or, you know, somebody that even sits outside my function, offers me feedback. I don't see that as like this, who are you to tell me anything? It's the, yeah, I totally get why you said that. Thank you. That was amazing insight. I love that. And I did, and they didn't see, they don't feel that as judgment. They feel that as, we are all trying to get better. And I think this is one of a book that I loved years ago, was called Tribal Leadership. And it talks about these different levels of culture in organizations. And oftentimes we get in this, the author described as a level 3 culture, where we think I'm great, but I'm better than you. And so, you know, any type of feedback's like, who are you to tell me that? I'm really good, versus this level 4 culture of, we are great and it's us against the competition. And when you can create that level 4 culture where we're seen as we, I think what you described is that getting feedback from different sources, you almost start to seek it versus, you know, it be this rare occurrence or this, like, almost this, you know, sense of, oh, you know, fear or competition.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? And even when somebody gives you feedback and you feel it's fundamentally flawed at its worst, the ability to go, but that's their perception. And even if they are wrong, how do I learn how to manage their perception?
Yeah.
You know, and even that becomes its own truth, right?
Totally. You know, it's funny. When I was doing my PhD, I took a class around qualitative research. And, you know, it was such a great, because you would take a class and it was instruction around, you know, how do you receive information if you're interviewing somebody and you're not, you know, make sure your body language is okay. And you're not, you know, don't, you know, you're not through your own way that you're receiving their responses, make them feel like you're judging it. And I've taken that to heart, even when I'm receiving feedback. And I tell everyone, take feedback as data. Like, don't judge it in the moment and be a researcher so that when you get feedback, you're not responding to it right away. Because if it's not something you like, you know, emotionally, you do a face or your body language and it already shapes a perception to the other individual. But if you treat feedback like data, you get to say, okay, great. Like a researcher, I'm going to put my data over here. And at the appropriate time, I'm then going to start to analyze it. And I think if we can do that more, A, we become much more receptive to feedback and people are much more willing to give it. But then it allows us, to your point, just because it's feedback doesn't mean it's necessarily right, but it is data that you can use to say, how am I showing up? How is other people's perception of me? And how do I want to treat this data? And should it cause a change in my future actions?
I like that a lot. And there's something that you used the word, you said, be a researcher. And that word be to me is hugely important. I'm coaching C-suite level individual right now. And I just noticed in the first couple of sessions that we had that he'll say things like, I need to listen. I have to make sure that they think I'm listening, etc. when I get feedback. And I go, well, that's kind of the reference point that we need to change. It's not that you need to. It's not that, because if you're sitting there going, I need to listen, I want them to believe I'm listening. That's very different. That's the doing. That's the task. But if you want to be the kind of leader where the narrative around you is that you listen, then your reason for doing it will have integrity. Therefore, unconsciously, people will not feel as if it's being done to them. So you could do the research because you went on a course and it told you to. So you can, but people might always feel it's contrived. But if you believe that you want to be that kind of leader, then the curiosity of your questions won't be seen as deflecting the feedback, but out of a genuine position of curiosity, because I actually want to know. So it's a self-definition thing as much as anything else, I sense. I don't know what you think.
Couldn't agree more. I think every leader that wants to be transformational should be able to put on their social scientist hat at different points, because that's how you start to solve and to hear and to listen and to observe. And when you start to do that and get really good at it, not only is it transformational to the teams that you lead, you also become, I think, a source of where people are like, I need so-and-so to come and sit and watch our team. They ask great questions and they share great observations, but it's because they look for things that most people might miss. And that's the social researcher, the scientists that just understand, you know, part of their role is to look for all things and to listen, not just for what, you know, what you're hoping to hear, but more importantly, what you were unexpecting. And that's, I think leaders that can do that really start to be transformational in not just the people they lead, but the organizations that they operate in.
Yes. I think within that, I like that. I'm also hearing a sense of, you know, look for the things that you don't like and look for the things that don't make sense to you and that sort of nudge up against what you believe but don't quite fit. Because otherwise, the experience of you is, of course, you agree with the stuff you like, right? Yeah. But you won't change, but you're not searching to be wrong.
You know, may we always ensure that we are, I guess, uncomfortable in hearing other people's opinions or observations, and that there's friction in your own ethos that challenges what you're trying to do, so that you can ensure that you're doing the right things. You know, as a leader, and you have your purpose and your values, I think it's so important to be clear in those, but also open to what others are doing, so that you are inclusive by nature, but also that you're seeing the world not from your view, but from many, many other people's perspectives.
Hmm. Wow. This is a great conversation for me, Spencer. So
I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I mean, this is, you know, we could talk about forever like this. It was funny. I was Stephen Frost, who was on one of my podcasts, and he's actually he's an inclusion diversity expert out of England. But he makes a challenge to people to say, surround yourself that are as different as you can possibly stand. And I love that, because that, I think, you know, and I challenge that to my teams, I challenge to me, I challenge that to my kids even, so that we might always see the world from different eyes. And anyways, I just think that, I think we need more of that, especially today.
It's very interesting. I've been a lifelong martial artist, and one of the things that you understand very, very quickly is that all the good ones surround themselves, or have learned from, or have put themselves into situations where they are continually the worst, one of the worst people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is, the second they get to a standard, they go and find a standard that's above them.
Yes.
And that might be, doesn't matter what it is, be it an individual or a school or whatever it is, but they constantly look for the person that can basically hand them their ass on a plate. By doing so, they are then constantly learning through the forging of themselves in the fire. And when you go to martial arts clubs and the instructor can beat everybody that's there, that's very different to going into a martial arts club where at least 25% of the instructor's senior attendees can beat them.
Mm-hmm.
Because what he's done or she's done is encouraged an environment of actually not dominance, but of going up against each other with the intent that there's no, don't beat the senior belt, or, you know, mm-hmm. that you have to respect the hierarchy. We'll beat each other respectfully, but in doing so, we'll get better and better and better. And of course, then they get surpassed. And you can always see that. So just that phraseology of surround yourself with people that, you know, constantly put you in that kind of state of intellectual angst, let's say, is very much, I think, true as an inherent way of people getting better.
Totally. Benjamin Hardy writes a book, and it's called Willpower Doesn't Work. And he talks about, like, habit change and, you know, how do you make personal change? But he's really clear is that environment will dictate who you become. And, you know, I used to sometimes say, shape your environment. And as much as you want to try to shape it, eventually the environment and the people that surround you, you eventually become a product of that. And so I now really encourage people to be very intentional around the people they're surrounding themselves with and the environment that they're in. Is it allowing them to go further, higher, and match who they're trying to become? Or is it kind of holding you back or helping you develop habits that aren't who you're trying to become? And so I could not agree more. Environment is so critical to the habits that we create, but I think ultimately where we go and what we do.
So with that in mind, where are you going? What's taking your headspace? What's the thinking that you're putting your efforts into?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think for me, so there's probably two big things that I'm super excited about right now. And so one is around this behavioral change, right? And unlocking both leaders and individual contributors to say the world needs a different type of mindset and a different type of leader. And, you know, leader is not by title. And how do we help individuals gain the confidence and build the appropriate skill that allows them to be successful and that keeps them in the mindset of I'm going to embrace new versus I'm going to sort of do new, but but I'm going to keep me back what's made me successful for the last 10 or 15 years. A, it's safe, and B, I've been rewarded for it. And I think, you know, one of the things that I am confident in is individuals that will continue to thrive are those ones that say, I see some trends happening and I'm willing to grow and try things that are new. So that's kind of, for me, area number one. And then the second area for me is, I think what helps organizations embrace what you talked about earlier, like, you know, how do you embrace this culture of learning and the spirit of feedback? And learning is always hard to measure. But what we're trying to do, and I'm super passionate about, is how do we have data and correlate data to what our organization is measuring? And when we can start to use data and take that data and derive insights from that, it really will help us transform our learning and the way that we design, I believe, in a much more creative way. But without that data and insight, I think we'll always kind of handicap ourselves to, you know, the hunches or the nudges that we think versus basing it on some hardcore research. And so we're really doubling down in this. Are we collecting the right data? Are we getting the right insights? And then are we evolving according to the data and not just, you know, the hunches that we see and feel?
And when that comes to people development, data is a very interesting debate for me, because very often if you say sales training and then sales go up, you can kind of go, well, you know, A led to B. When you do leadership development or that personal development thing, a very ambivalent statement there from somebody that his entire career is based on it. When you are in that space, it can be not always a straight line as to how you identify the input to the output.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without going down a rabbit hole of that, I think I have an interest in just any kind of way that I approach making those less obvious linkages. And is that because of people's subjective experience? Is it through their career progression? Is it through, what are the things that you are top line are looking at?
No, to your point, right? And it kind of feels like, it feels like it's the holy grail. Like, can we ever achieve, you know, measuring leadership development growth? Or, you know, do certain learning experiences directly impact an outcome? And, you know, to be fair, we'll probably never get there because there are so many variables. But I, you know, what we're trying to do is identify what variables we can measure. And how do you hold something constant and have a control group and an experiment group, having your variables, but then also measuring them to a certain outcome, and then taking that data and say, is there anything there that shows cause and impact? And sometimes we're seeing things and sometimes we don't. And so I think that's okay, because I think as we continue this journey of trying to be able to show some what I'll call, you know, hardcore data, I think we're getting closer, but only because of, you know, technology today. You know, data scientists today are amazing, but it does require like a sense of discipline and also a way that you know, because not every organization is actually into it. They're like, I'm not, you know, that's not what I'm really interested in. Just do this, check the box. But you also have to have an organization that embraces learning and that they truly believe it's a culture, or it's, you know, when you create a culture of learning, that it does drive performance. When you can get that, you can also then start to do the, what I would call the rigor of the data analysis that starts to show these trends. But you have to be disciplined to say, we're going to measure what the organization measures. And if you can do that and align with that, you can then start to speak the same language as your stakeholders, so that it also starts to be hard to argue. So you get to say, look, you might not love the process, but here's some data that is pretty scientific, you know, and I think that's part of it. It's the rigor around how you're setting up your analysis so that it's hard to refute it. And, you know, being a data and a science company, you know, we try to take pride in that so that when somebody does try to poke some holes in it, we're like, you know what, we've tried to account for that, and here's what we've done.
There's a virtuous circle there, isn't there, that if you can create the evidence that aligns to the commercial imperatives, then the business is more likely to see that learning as a commercial imperative, therefore put more energy into it, therefore giving you more data, therefore...
Totally. You
know, so I don't know if it's chicken and egg, but you're looking for the breakthrough moment to evidence it, to then go, ah, if we do more of that, I can give you more of this.
Yes. Well, and it's a tremendous amount of stakeholder management, right? Like your stakeholders have to believe you know what you're doing, and they have to believe, you know, so there's all of that work that needs to happen in parallel with the actual measurement piece. And, you know, so you've got to be able to do both.
Yeah, and they've got to want to do it or be motivated to do it when they actually are in a space of maybe anxiety or pressure.
Totally. Yes. Well, to your point, right? Like, we're heading into Q4, and I think every organization is like, okay, especially this year where you've
I was really up for it in Q1, but right now I'm a bit busy.
Yeah. Well, you know, you think about, you know, with COVID, the pressure to make up whatever happened, to your point, even becomes greater. And so sometimes we will shortchange the process of learning or training because you might just say, we don't have time. And versus you're like, no, I need my folks to do this if it's designed right. So it's in the flow of work where I'm not signing up for hours upon hours courses, but it helps me in my everyday performance.
Hmm. So listen, we've been talking for nearly 50 minutes, believe it or not.
Oh my goodness.
Which has either been the longest 50 minutes of your life or it's gone quite quickly.
Well, let the listeners tell, right? Like, you could tell us, like, did you drop off 30 minutes ago or what?
Yeah, there's only two of them left. You know, maybe we'll do a part two, right? But it's, I didn't see you join in there with a yes. That's what
I would love. I would love a part two. I mean, that's,
I'm sure we will. It sounds like we will. As I just look forward, you know, COVID is just, you know, it's one of those things I almost don't want to talk about it because I'm sick of flipping talking about it. But it's just so significant that it's worth a final statement. And we're just going into a 6-month lockdown, well, quasi lockdown again in the UK, which is very interesting for those that had the strategy of, well, we'll start that face-to-face development again, you know, once COVID's passed. Well, boom, guess what? Doesn't look like it's passing in any time soon. So I would just be just interested to get a sense of maybe the shift of those kind of delivery mechanisms and how they're landing. Have they worked surprisingly well? Have you been surprised? Has it been, well, you know, I can't wait to get us all back in a room again? Or
yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, who knows? I don't think we'll ever go back to the level of face-to-face that we did. And I think that's probably a good thing, because I think what we are learning is that you can accomplish so much virtually if you've designed the experience right. And and I think what this has done, I talk about digital dexterity and how do we ensure that for my team and for myself, I no longer can I let my daughter or, you know, somebody that's younger than me update my iPhone and help me download a new app or figure out how to, you know, do things. We have to ensure that we are up to date on the latest technology, so that if I'm running a Zoom call or a webinar or whatever, I can throw up and get people to do word clouds. I can in a moment do a survey. I can input the video without making it stop. So I think there's something about, A, we have to increase our digital dexterity to create a learning experience that probably wouldn't even be able to exist if we were face to face. And I think as we continue to do that, what we will do is we're understanding when we do get face to face, how do we maximize that experience so that we're not actually wasting it? You know, I probably think when we got people together, there was a ton of wasted time. One of the other things my prediction is when we get back to face to face, we might actually just want people to actually talk. And I think that might be less design and more human interaction and the other stuff we do virtually. So those are some of the things that we're thinking about and some of the things that we're really over-indexing on.
So come together for high quality conversations, turn up with the learning done.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Beautiful thing. Okay. Well, listen, Spencer, I'm going to bring us to a halt. It's been a magnificent experience for me. Thank you so much. I've thoroughly enjoyed your energy and your insights. And I don't always say that with such vigor.
The pleasure has been mine. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Absolute pleasure. So I'm going to press stop on the recording and we'll have a little chat after. So don't disappear. So thanks very much once again, Spencer.
Perfect.
That's it. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please share so others get to hear about us and subscribe so you keep up to date on new episodes. Also visit livingbrave.com if you want to connect with me and find out more about executive coaching, team effectiveness and changing culture. Oh, and of course you can buy my book Living Brave Leadership on Amazon. So on that note, see you soon.